Before we begin this morning's talk on man, the microcosm of the macrocosm, we just would like to clarify that for the purposes of this presentation, when we use the term man for convenience sake, we are referring to men and women, the human being, humanity in general. So let's begin with this question. What does it mean that man is the microcosm of the macrocosm? Now, we have this quote from The Secret Doctrine by HPB, Volume 1, 274, which we like to read because it gives us a good starting point. The universe is worked and guided from within outwards. As above, so it is below. As in heaven, so on earth. And man, the microcosm and miniature copy of the macrocosm, is the living witness to this universal law and to the mode of its action. So when we use this term, man is the microcosm of the macrocosm, it's not an emotional sentiment. Nor is it a poetic metaphor. It is a fact in nature, which is called the law of correspondences. As above, so below. Key to this understanding is the idea, and we gathered this from our reading in the Gita this morning, that everything in all its kingdoms, in the mineral, vegetable, animal, and human kingdom, is alive and conscious in its own degree. The universe itself, as a whole, and every atom in it, is ensouled. And to paraphrase Mr. Judge from the Ocean of Theosophy, all is soul and spirit, ever evolving in forms of matter under the rule of law inherent in the whole. In this presentation this morning, we will outline the expression of this law of correspondences in the cosmic principles of the universe, the macrocosm, and in the seven principles of the human constitution, the microcosm. Then we will explore some of the practical and ethical implications. So, the first idea to be grasped and understood is that the macrocosm, the universe, is a living being. The universe evolves from the absolute one unknowable source. Except to say that it is the one infinite unity and reality which is the source of all beings. It cannot be described in words, as it is beyond human thought, language, and comprehension. However, one can say what it is not. It is no thing and it is no being, because it is limitless and without end. It has no attributes. It is not spirit or matter, but the unity and basis of both. The first manifestation of the universe from and within this one eternal unmanifested reality is spirit, or the one life, along with matter and mind. Therefore, the universe and every world and everything in it is spirit working intelligently through some form of matter. In other words, the universe, a world, as a human being, are all living beings subject to the cycle of birth, activity and rest, growth, decay, disintegration and death, regeneration and change. Everything in the universe, throughout all its kingdoms, the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, the human, is guided from within outwards. And here's a point that HPB makes on that same page in The Secret Doctrine. Quote, "We see that every external motion, act, gesture, whether voluntary or mechanical, organic or mental, is produced and preceded by an internal feeling or emotion, will or volition, and thought or mind. As no outward motion or change when normal in man's external body can take place unless provoked by an inward impulse given through one of these three functions named, so with the external or manifested universe." So this concept of evolution, or everything being guided from within outwards, is another one of the evidences that man is a mirror or a copy of the macrocosm, the universe. So the universe, as the human being, has an indwelling spirit and soul nature, which impels and directs the outer physical form or body. Now, what we have in theosophy are names to these inner and outer principles in nature and man, so that we can identify them, study them, and see how they can be practically applied. Because names are powerful to the extent we understand and can use them. So the universe, we are told, manifests in seven ways or on seven planes in all worlds, in all beings, causing everything that manifests to have a sevenfold nature. And that is just a copy or a mirror of the cosmic process, as the universe itself is sevenfold. So everything in nature, being interconnected and from the one source, follows that same law of a sevenfold manifestation. However, in the human being, we have the most complete active expression of that sevenfold nature. So all the forces of nature associated with those planes and principles exist, at least potentially, in man as well. The next significant message we want to get is of this microcosm, or the sevenfold man that we spoke of, which is a mirror of the sevenfold nature of the universe. And for this part of our presentation, we're going to fall back on the terms and ideas given in this regard that can be found in the Key to Theosophy on page 90, and in The Ocean of Theosophy by Mr. Judge in chapter 2. And although we are going to use numbers to just identify these principles, we're not using it in the sense of giving any order, but just for the purpose of this presentation. So the first idea we have is that the Sanskrit word Atma represents this universal spirit, which is in everything. It is one with the absolute, and we might think of it as a radiation of the absolute, just as the ray of light is a radiation and one with and identical in origin with the sun. The second principle that we are told about is Buddhi, the universal soul or vehicle of Atma, and also it is everywhere present, and it corresponds to this one universal spirit. Manas, or mind, intelligence, is the third principle we'll speak of. And for the human being, Manus is the immortal incarnating ego or thinker, and it corresponds in the universe to the intelligent part of the universe, or that in which the plan of the universe or cosmos is fixed. And sometimes this is spoken of as universal mind. So just as the mind is the incarnating aspect of the human being, cosmic mind contains the plan for the manifesting universe brought over from a previous period of evolution. So the universe itself is a never-ending process of becoming. There's a period of activity and rest, manifestation and disappearance, but then at another point, the universe comes forth again, and the plan that will guide it is brought over in universal mind to carry on and direct the process. So these three higher principles of Atma, Buddhi, Manas, or spirit, spiritual soul, and mind make up for the human being his invisible, changeless, spiritual, creative nature. And also their corresponding aspects or the spiritual, invisible, changeless, creative processes of the universe. So the universe and man together have this spiritual aspect. And then we come to the four lower principles. When we use the term lower, we mean primarily that they are manifesting in lower degrees of substance and lower planes of nature. And in truth, they're all from the same source, and in essence, they're all necessary importance. So we only speak of them as higher and lower, depending on the plane in which they are operating. So the fourth principle in the human being is called kama. It is our desire nature, the seat of our feelings, our passions, and desires. And in the universe, this corresponds to the will or the force of spirit in action. So wherever spirit intelligence exerts itself, we see some aspect of will. And that is the same for the human being. And then we come to a fifth idea, and we'll use the Sanskrit term for it, linga sarira, which is the astral model or design body upon which the physical body is built. And it's said to be electromagnetic in nature. And this, as we heard referred to in our reading from the Gita, on a universal sense, is called Akasha. It's the first emanation of that primordial matter and spirit. So, as this Akasha is the connecting link between matter on one hand and spirit mind on the other, the astral body in the human being is the connecting link between the physical body on the one hand and the inner psychic spiritual man on the other. So we speak of the inner psychic spiritual man as being the real human being, according to theosophy, and the astral body as being the real physical, because it is enduring and lasts longer. It's the model upon which our the physical molecules of our physical body arrange themselves. The next principle we want to talk about is called prana or life. It is the vital principle, and it's necessary for the function and coherence of all our lower principles, our desire principle, astral body, and the physical body during life. We might think of it as breath. And of course, it's not just the breath that we breathe in through our lungs and expel through our lungs, but it is that vitalizing energy that maintains all the processes in our lower nature. And it corresponds in the universal sense to this pervasive ocean of life energy, spiritual and material in the cosmos. So, from the perspective of the ancient wisdom, life is an all-pervading force or energy that precedes form. It is instrumental in the production of form. It is not the outcome or the result of the operation of form. So forms may come and go, but life, energy, spirit, if you will, is enduring. And finally, we have what is called in Sanskrit the physical body, the vehicle of all the other principles we mentioned during life. And just as the physical body is our objective manifestation to others in the world, it corresponds to this objective physical matter of our physical universe, which is only the lowest and most dense expression of matter in the cosmos. So when we look out and see all the planets and stars and galaxies, that's only the lowest manifestation of what the ancients called the cosmos or the universe. There being hidden aspects to it, just as there are hidden aspects to us. So these lower four principles we talked about in the human being, the body of our passions and desires, our astral body, the life principle, the physical body, are visible and invisible, but they all change. They're all temporary. They're all transient. They're all subject to disintegration or what we call death. And they make up the mortal human being with the temporary principles that make up our personality in any one life. And they correspond to the visible, invisible, changing aspects of the universe around us. So we often hear the expression, if there's anything that's constant, it's change. And that's certainly true in this lower aspect of ourselves and the universe. But behind it all, as Krishna reminds us, there's this enduring universal spiritual nature, not only in man, but also in the universe as well. And he that is becomes aware of that in themselves and in others and in the universe is not disturbed by anything that may come to pass. So man, the thinker, the human being, not only the mirrors the universe within himself, but in his nature are the keys to understanding the mysteries of the universe and control of its creative forces. Man unites all the forms and all the essences from all the planes and from all the kingdoms of nature within himself. And we can see this in a limited way when we realize that even our physical bodies are made up of substance from the mineral, the vegetable, the animal kingdom, and the human kingdom. But not just the objective stuff, but we share with all the kingdoms, the invisible lives, intelligences that mold and shape the various forms. So we are a microcosm of the macrocosm in that sense. So here is one of the important takeaways. If man is the microcosm or the mirror of the macrocosm, the universe, the human being is also the bridge between the two. So when we begin to ask ourselves, what is our purpose? What is the role of our lives? What is the purpose of humanity? What is it, the ideal to which it aspires? So, as man is a mirror of the universe, a microcosm to the macrocosm, so too, man is the macrocosm to the lower kingdoms of nature. They are small copies of us. As said, we share with them from our own nature, just as they share with us. But in their natures, they don't express the complete active expression of the universe. Only in the human kingdom we have that, because there's a principle active, one of those seven principles active in the human kingdom that is not completely active in any other kingdom of nature. And that is the real man, the thinker, who has the capacity for free will and choice. So manas, or mind, the thinker, is the link between spirit and matter, between the immortal spiritual nature and the temporary personality or body. He or she is the bridge between spiritual nature and physical nature. But that's not only just in ourselves. Man is also the bridge for all of nature between the higher and the lower. And why is that practical and important? Because the thinker, the real human being, because of their free will and choice, can gravitate downwards towards their passions and desires and live but to satisfy and fulfill and act upon them. Or man, the thinker, can gravitate upwards towards its spiritual Buddhi nature, that which is universal and shared by all. So all our acts and feelings can, through our free will and choice and self-devised effort, be directed towards that purpose. And as we make that effort, as we try to change and act from a higher perspective, as Krishna tells us, there is a change in our conscious awareness. We become one with and aware of that universal spirit operating in nature and all of the life around us. But it is a realization, it is a power that does not affect us. As we awaken our consciousness, as we raise our level of thinking and feeling to a spiritual nature, because of our interconnection with all the kingdoms of nature, because they are all reflected and contained within us, we raise up the consciousness and matter in all the lower kingdoms of nature. The mineral, the vegetable, the animal respond as they are conscious and intelligent in their own degree to our impulse. Practically, what does this mean? If we are a microcosm of the macrocosm, we have to align our principles, especially the lower principles of our nature, with the cosmic nature and become a co-worker with nature. So the best way to think about this is if we were very talented as a pianist or a violinist, and had in our mind, or on the paper before us, a beautiful symphony by Beethoven or Mozart that we could hear in our mind, that we could see on the page, that we listen to on the radio, but the instrument we were using, the strings, the keys, were out of tune or broken, we could not produce that music. We could not make it practical or manifested. So we need a tuning process. We need to be able to set straight, to tune the keys and the strings to what we know to be that real music. And this, we have to do the same thing every day. We have to examine our thoughts, our feelings, our actions. And if we detect that we are out of alignment with the universal, then we strive to correct that, to become a co-worker with nature. So what happens if we don't? Because we have free will and choice, even though we're a mirror of the macrocosm, the mirror still can still be broke. We still can break the mirror, in which case we cannot reflect back our true nature or have any practical purpose. So if we don't do that, we don't become a co-worker with nature, We pretty much corresponding produce music that is out of tune, disharmonious. So because then we so we're getting now into the practical and ethical considerations. Because we are a copy, a microcosm of the macrocosm, all our actions, all our thoughts, all our feelings resonate, vibrate like the strings we spoke about throughout nature. Hence, responsibility, taking responsibility for our own actions, making discipline and cultivating our nature, taking care of our soul nature, our necessities of universal brotherhood, as it is a fact in nature. If we are interconnected, if we are all one, we cannot neglect that care, that responsibility with that discipline without having some type of injurious, degrading, or obstructing effect on ourselves and the world around us. So the establishment of a nucleus of universal brotherhood based on the spiritual identity of all and the interconnectedness of all and the fact that we are a copy of the universe as above, as below, establishing that nucleus of universal brotherhood within ourselves and with others mirrors the harmony and balance in nature itself. So when we read the ancient words of wisdom, man or human being, know thyself. This is not only a moral imperative, it becomes a service to humanity. So we say here that the lodge regards as Theosophists all those who are engaged in the true service of humanity. So that means that whatever our background, our creed, our nation, our race, our condition, if we are striving to understand not just our lower nature, but our higher nature and potential, and will it into action to bring forth that light into manifestation in our lives and to express it in our relationship to others, we are performing the true service to humanity and to all of life. So we'll finish here. This is a very expansive subject and is probably a keynote to all the considerations we will take up this month under the umbrella theme of theosophical principles, general theosophical principles. And it's not that it meant that we comprehend all of this at one time, because we will be taking it up in smaller aspects throughout the year. But we are laying before ourselves the framework, the syllabus, so to speak, of our study and effort throughout the coming year. So we invite your questions and comments at this time. Okay, MDW.
So for the practical connectivity of all of us is love and compassion. Are those the highest ideals in which we connect with all of life?
So is the highest ideal love and compassion? So is this the highest ideal of all of life? So we said that man, the human being, is the mirror of the universe. And within his or her own nature, they reflect cosmic universal laws or processes. So when we look at the action of love or compassion, it is not a physical thing that we can measure, taste, smell, touch. Its manifestations may be, but in itself, it is an invisible spiritual psychic power. We say it's spiritual because it's in every human being. And we say it's psychic because the way we think about it and apply it with our feelings is individual to our own nature and our own development. and it grows throughout the years. So we become compassionate and loving in different ways of thought and feeling. That is our evolving spiritual nature. That's the way we see it in ourselves. But what is love and compassion in the universal sense, the impersonal sense? We say that it is the cosmic process of balance and harmony and fitness of all things. So we see in this universe of manifestation a duality of spirit and matter. We see opposing forces. We see outward forces and inward forces and chaotic forces and organizing forces and centripetal and centripetal forces. We see the effects of matter, the effects of spirit. We see all kinds of diversity. But unless we had this underlying principle of harmony and balance, there could be no order. Everything would be chaotic. So when we look and we see the stars predictable, we see the planets in a predictable course, we see nature springing forth year after year in a predictable way, it's because of this underlying law of harmony and balance of all nature to bring everything back to one stability, one unity, itself being a reflection of that one absolute source from which everything comes and everything is a manifestation. So when we act, we become in a loving, compassionate way. When we follow that path as best we can, and of course, that best grows as we study and understand ourselves better, as best we can. We, in our own sense, are copying that universal process and becoming co-workers with nature. If we, because we have free will and choice, refuse to do so, because we are gravitating down more towards our lower passionate nature and more self-centered and selfish in that regard or perspective, then we are in opposition to that law of harmony. And sooner or later, the universe itself, the laws of harmony and balance itself, trying to reestablish unity in everything, will bring us under karma to those situations where we will experience the consequences of those actions and hopefully learn through them, either through the interaction with others better and wiser and more powerful and more understanding than ourselves, or perhaps through suffering and pain, which forces us to look into ourselves and try to figure out why is this happening to me? What can I do? And determine to do things better. So, in a very simple way, the message of all the great philosophers and world reformers down through the age has been the same practical ethics and morals. The philosophy of it, the metaphysics of it, that we've very briefly tried to touch upon today, has not necessarily been given out in its fullness, but the heart of it, the soul of it, in that, do unto others as you would have others do unto you, is present throughout all religions in the world. Another thought?
Yes, there's an aspect of mind that we see around us that some minds are reflective and some minds are not. They seem to be totally engrossed in the moment or in the material world, and they don't seem to reflect on anything other than that. Is a reflective mind a development, or is it just a process of becoming?
So, what is this mind? What does it mean for it to be reflective? Very interesting question because we spoke of man, the microcosm of the macrocosm, the mirror in which the universe is expressed and manifested. So, if it's a mirror, it has to reflect. And so, what does self-consciousness mean? A self-conscious mind mean? It means it's a reflective mind. It means that, like the mirror, we can turn it lower, higher, to the side, up, down, within, out. We can turn it in different directions. And where we return it, we become aware of possibilities, contrasts, and we can make decisions. That process of self-reflection, that versatility of mind is not present in the lower kingdoms. So we can use that mind and reflect it upwards to the spiritual nature. And how do we do that? Well, we do that. We listen to speakers, or we read books, or we listen to podcasts, or we study, and we begin to think about them. And as we reflect on them, we see in those things truths that resonate already within us. We can see that what we're being exposed to from without already exists within. It's like, oh, I see that. I see that. I see that reflection in myself. I know that to be true. And we find it very inspiring. But then the mind, as we're told, is like a mirror. It is a mirror, and it gathers dust while it reflects, because we all haven't developed. We have that potentially to direct that mind wherever we want to. But right now, in our evolution, our desire principle, our passions and desires, is stronger than that mind. The mind is developing with every passage of time. But right now, the desire principle is developing. So as our mind reflects, it sort of is more swayed down towards the passions and desires and those influences. So that's the dust that it gathers. And that's where we have to do the retuning, the dust away, the brush, the dust of our illusions. And one of the ways of brushing it away is to be aware of this law of correspondence. As above, so below. If we see pollution in the environment, if we see chaos in society, if we see darkness in the world, we reflect that in ourselves to some degree. And our first duty is to clear it up within our own nature. And as we become more clear seeing of the possibilities, then we can begin to help others see it within themselves. They still will have to do the work. They're still self-conscious thinkers. They'll steer the mirrors, but we can begin to help them turn that mirror and begin to reflect on higher possibilities within themselves and others. Yes, Theosophy Hall. Unmute, please. Theosophy Hall, we cannot hear you. Can you unmute, please? Right. We'll come back. We'll watch to see when you get on. We'll come back. Unless you want to send in a chat. Any other questions?
Okay.
Oh, we have a question. Is that
It
Liz? Liz, yeah.
is Liz.
Hi, Liz. You have a question?
Hello. Yes, and well, I'll try to phrase it as a question. So when you talk about the mind and evolving, so would you think the more of us get together and evolve our minds, the better it is for collective consciousness to evolve?
Yes. Good. It's a good point. We can make the effort individually, but we know that in anything, a team effort is better. You can have a great athlete, but a team that's not working together, that athlete is useless. You know, that superior athlete is useless. That the real power and strength and progress of a team depends on everyone working together. And everyone's a link. And we use the term the weakest link. But all that means is that the link is necessary. So we do our best to function to the best of our ability, and others will do the best to help us. And we all come into this with different strengths and abilities because of our previous efforts and individual evolution. So where we are strong in one area, another person may be strong in another. And it's likewise with our weaknesses. So working together, we can see and feel and be aware and do things together that we couldn't do individually. And one of the things we can do better together is to raise our consciousness. Because as individuals and having that mirror which reflects downward and gathers dust, when we're operating with our lower mind, which we mostly do, we cannot help but be blinded or deluded or prejudiced or superstitious or biased. And so one of the ways we clear out that mind is having it rub up or buff up against the mind of another. And by that interaction, they help us see things and erase things and change things that we would might not ordinarily recognize. And we do that for them as well. And in that sense, children become the saviors and instructors of their parents as much as parents become the teachers when they're responsible for their children, and both grow up and evolve together in a normal situation. So yes, it is in unity that we as mind beings grow together. But let's not forget that the lower kingdoms are conscious and intelligent too. So if we do not give care, proper care in our relationship to the intelligences in the lower kingdom, they will reflect it back through their intelligence to us. And if we neglect or obstruct their vision, their perception, their awareness, they in their way, in their influence, will rebound and obstruct ours. So universal brotherhood is a fact in nature. It doesn't just relate to our communication relationships with other mind beings like ourselves, but with all intelligent life.
I wholeheartedly agree. Very good. Thank
Theosophy Hall now.
Can you hear us now?
Very well.
Okay. With the microcosm, where does Fohat come in? What is Fohat? Please elaborate.
Okay. Well, Fohat, first of all, is a Sanskrit term. Sanskrit term. And in the Hindu literature, it can be confusing because in their method of symbolism, they often take cosmic forces and processes and anthropomorphize them or make them personal and refer to them as gods or goddesses. And so Fohat is one of these beings or forces of nature that are personalized. So when you read in certain Eastern literature of gods and goddesses, they're really symbolizing in the use of those terms various forces in nature, how they correlate. And so Fohat, as a force in nature, is likened to electricity. What does electricity do? Well, electricity itself is everywhere. But it has to be channeled to be effective. And so electricity is that force of nature which vivifies, which is necessary for the expression of energy on any plane of substance, whether it's in our emotional nature, our physical nature, whether we're talking about the processes of the world. It's that energy, that electricity, that force that works through matter. Now, in the human being, what relates to that the most is our will. And by this, we mean the action of our highest thought, the vivification and action of our highest thought. So that's the difference between will and desire. Because we are activated, we do things out of our desire. Mostly it's desires for ourselves or for those we love, desire to avoid things, desire to attract things, desire to have things that we love, desire to avoid things that we hate. That's the motivating force for most of our desire. It's our lower desire. But our desire can also be expanded, redirected, like the mind, and we can really desire and love to do things for other people for their benefit, to help them. And as we do that, we become, what are we doing? We are getting an idea. We have an idea, a perception that we're not here just for ourselves. We intuitively know that we are part of the whole. We are interconnected. This is the mystic. Those who have an inner connection and realization that they are one with the divine, that they're interconnected with the whole, that they are responsible. That's the mystic, or that's the real spiritual experience spoken of by William James. That's the essence of a true religious devotee, regardless of their creed. So that is a thought of universal brotherhood in action, and we act from that basis. That's will on the human level. In the universal level, it's that energy, it's that force, it's that electricity that has its origin in that universal mind. The plan brought forth from previous periods of evolution that this is the way the universe should express itself. And the universe is guided from within outward by that will, just as we are guided from within outward by our will, if we choose to use it. So that's why it's important to study, to examine your ideas, because ideas rule the world, as Plato said, ideas rule us. And if we don't rule our ideas, they will rule us. And so we want to be careful of the ideas we hold and we take in from others. Yes, MDW.
Well, you said behind will stands desire, and we're presently, our desires are what are influencing mostly of all of our decisions, or well, they motivate all our decisions. So, what is the avenue of getting out of this quagmire that we've created with our emotions and with our feelings?
No. So what is the avenue? The avenue is self-knowledge, self-awareness. That's why we've taken so much time this morning of taking advantage of theosophy's definition and explanation of who and what we are. If we think we are these lower personalities, if we think we are these desires, if we think we are these bodies, and subsequently, if we think we are this personality and body that just lives once, is separated from others, and then after that, who knows what happens. If that's what we think we are, that's how we know ourselves to be, we will be ruled by those lower parts of our nature, because that's who we think we really are. But if we begin to expand our self-awareness, and we see that, no, we have a spiritual nature. There's something that's higher. There's something that's more universal. There's something that's reasoning. There's something that's compassion. Then as thinkers, we know now that we are thinkers in reality, that we have the choice. We can choose between one and another. Now, we have that choice potentially, but we can give it up. We can sacrifice it. We can give up any treasure that belongs to us. And if we don't take care and exercise that choice to respond to the higher inner nature, either by habit or tendency, we will more and more become subject to the lower. And as we are adding in the Halloween season, still we're reminded of that story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You remember that terrifying story where we have this individual who through chemical means, learns to separate his better instincts from his lower, and gives in more and more to the lower, and sooner or later it results in the death and destruction of both. Well, that's an allegory, that's a warning tale, that if we do not become aware of both and make choices, that we will do things to ultimately hurt ourselves and also hurt others. So we won't end on that note, but we will end on the note that you all have the power to make it a good day.
You're here.